For the last 300 years, we have gradually intensified what might be termed our scientific program. With the rise of humanism in the 16th and 17th centuries in Europe, human attention focused almost directly upon the material advancement of society. There is good reason why this should have happened. For a long time, the average, even so-called cultured person, had given practically no consideration to the pressing problems of social change. There was no consistent recognition of the rights of man, his rights of decent living, his rights of education, religious freedom, his rights to improve his techniques and skills, broaden his knowledge and understanding. By degrees, however, this emphasis, well justified at the time, became excessive. Slowly, the universe of values disappeared, and in its place came the universe of utilities. Progress came to be measured entirely in the physical advancements in the arts and sciences. It was inevitable that this unbalanced condition should ultimately lead to some kind of a crisis. Whenever we develop a lopsided and unbalanced and unreasonable perspective, we must pay for it. And in the 19th century, we made the dramatic shift from a religious cultural to an economic industrial basis. Then the era of invention became dominant, and one discovery after another increased our conveniences and also complicated our problems. So today we have the atomic bomb, which might be regarded as the inevitable end of an attitude. It might have been delayed a little longer, but man being what he is, with the pressures and intensities peculiar to his kind, living under a psychological situation such as now prevails, was moved by forces beyond his control, step by step, relentlessly, to the present state of affairs. The only way we can understand it is to recognize that it demonstrates the immutable processes of cause and effect. We have sowed the whirlwind. Now we must reap the whirlwind. Had we been more careful, more thoughtful, we would have had a better state of affairs. But being creatures of extremes, of intensities, of great pressures, we never have been able to advance any program with dignity and moderation. The spiritual situation, therefore, comes home to each and every one of us. Probably this is what nature has intended. Man has always learned the hard way, and he seldom accepts facts until they slap him in the face or bring to bear upon him some condition which halts him in consternation. The gradual decline of religious intensity has lowered our ethical levels, has weakened our internal resistance to stress, and has left us, much like Cardinal Wolsey, naked to our enemies. These enemies, in this case, being our own intellectual productions. But we must live with what we have. The knowledge is not going to be taken away. It may be possible that we might have a bad setback in the development of an atomic program. But we cannot again forget the strange, dangerous instrument we have devised. So now we must learn to live with it. We must also recognize that its danger lies not in itself, but in ourselves. The atomic bomb is comparatively harmless unless man, through his own psychic tensions, releases it upon himself and upon society. So the bomb is not the danger. The man is the danger. The individual who has not yet matured his own consciousness, has not yet reached a state of self-discipline, has been handed this terrible instrument. And we are hoping, against hope, that he will not use it. Religion has to meet this problem in two ways. First, it has to build as rapidly as possible within man the kind of spiritual integrity which will prevent him from the destructive use of atomic power. This means that from the standpoint of the religious life of mankind, there has to be an immediate and rapid shift from religion as a theory, as a policy, as a sectarianism, to religion as a dynamic experience within our own lives. To live at all, man must live by a better religious code. This is difficult, and perhaps this difficulty can be summarized in the fact I received in the mail 2 or 3 days ago quite an elaborate brochure which should have been and could have been written about 1850. It's a full 110 years behind its time. It was the type of thing that we might have expected a fervent missionary to write in a desperate effort to protect his own creed, not only from assault by other Christians, but particularly from the assault of non-Christian worshippers. In this time, the brochure is most untimely. It again attempts to emphasize the inevitable rights of one Christian sect not only to differ from all other religions of the world, but to declare without hesitation that all these others are wrong. Not only wrong, but so very wrong that it becomes the duty of the true believer to remain completely intolerant of them, or become that way for the good of his own immortal soul. Now, this is very unfortunate, because if the world today has one defense against the chaos of materialism, it is the vast body of religious peoples everywhere in the world. Materialism is a two-pronged adversary. First, it is represented by materialistic political structures. and we think in terms of world communism. It is also represented by materialistic intellectual levels. And in this group, we have a great many educators, scientists, and persons in our own communities who have developed this intense materialism. Against these dangers, and they are real dangers, we have only the goodwill of people of strong faith. Now, it makes very little difference at the moment which one of the five great religions of the world these people belong to. Because they believe in God, because they believe in the brotherhood of man, because they believe in peace rather than war, because they believe that there is a spiritual destiny which man must face, spiritual laws which he must obey, a spiritual power at the source of life, because they have these beliefs, they are our friends, and our very necessary friends at this time. Yet in a day when the survival of all faiths is hazarded, we have denominations picking at each other. Not only picking at each other in a rather nasty, nice way, but actually pointing out to the devout members of their own groups that it is a mortal sin to unite with these other people. Now, this is just about as dangerous to us as the bomb, because it is destroying the instrument with which we must attempt to hold the world together. The world is not only in danger of falling apart because of atomic fission, it is in danger of falling apart because there seems to be no real desire to keep it together. If our civilization goes, it will not go because of the bomb. It will go because man has cultivated and protected for hundreds of years attitudes which had in them the very substance of disintegration. So we are concerned now in thinking through how we are going to meet on a spiritual level the challenge of this tremendous scientific discovery. We know politically and socially that we must be one world or perish. We now also begin to suspect that we must be one religion or have none, and that the weakness in our own spiritual unity is almost certainly going to leave us the victim of the animosities and prejudices, ill feelings, and resentments of persons whom we have hurt spiritually as well as materially. So we have to think very much along these lines. We are faced by one enemy, essentially, the enemy of scientific skill. This adversary is highly organized, also has its dedications to progress, to the advancement of knowledge, is served by persons with a strange devotion to the ideas of science, and held in a kind of hypnotic trance by the fantasy of the scientific approach to life. These people, however, are well integrated as a group. They are going on their way. They know what they are doing. Day by day, they are expanding their knowledge and their skill. Not all in a destructive direction, but too much of it in that direction. Against this highly organized program rises the voice of popular indignation, a strong dissent, but a dissent of peoples that have never actually formed one structure, but have spoken as individuals without even a general sense of common sympathy. They are not a solid pattern of conviction. They are merely fragments of fear rising up in all parts of the world and asking some kind of peace in this time of trouble. This situation will not fit the times, and I think we are, as never before, in our spiritual emergency, faced with something that has always been one of our greatest difficulties, and that is that we have outgrown the sectarian concept of religion. We are in a condition now where we must begin to think in terms of one world religion. This does not mean that we must demand religious conformities, but we must divide between religious essentials and religious non-essentials. We must recognize the importance of a common unity on those levels in which our survival is involved. Perhaps what we need is something not patterned unlike the great political movements that are attempting world peace or attempting to maintain an uneasy armistice at this time. Just as it is necessary for the nations of the world to sit down together and try by every possible means to arbitrate their differences, so it is necessary for the religions of the world, with far greater justification than policy can ever have, to sit down together and recognize the spiritual emergency that is affecting the entire world, and that unless religion unites in this emergency, it will not only fail to contribute to the common good, but may very well destroy itself utterly. It is no longer a matter in which we have the luxury of our prejudices. It is now a matter of unite for survival. Not only for the survival of religious conviction, but for the survival of man under a way of life that can give him spiritual security, without which he cannot function. Man is a religious creature, and if he does not have the strength of his religion, his entire ethical structure loses tone, loses value. Now, we know these problems exist. We would like to do something about them, but most persons today are a little hesitant in daring to hope that anything on a world level will actually be done. If the conditions arising today, and which certainly will become more and more intense in the next year or two, if these conditions do not point the way to what is necessary, we can have very little hope that the human being is capable of spiritual brotherhood. We must continue to assume that his religion is on his lips, but not in his life. This does not mean that everyone is lacking in these qualities, but that the great formal structures upon which religious motion depends either lack the courage or the insight to sacrifice their own peculiar prejudices for the preservation of the essential principle of religion. It looks as though we were again going to be confronted with the problem of working out our own salvation. The individual, recognizing his own needs, must build his own religion, perhaps deriving it from the faiths familiar to him, perhaps not actually departing from the broad structure of prevailing religious teaching, but making certain powerful applications within his life and achieving in himself the tolerance which the world does not seem to be able to attain. So we may feel at the moment that as the crisis spreads, as the problem deepens, that the average person must begin to consider his own place in this world emergency. We read various accounts of what might happen and the tremendous potential destruction that could follow the use of atomic missiles. We also realize that the Holocaust, proclaimed in these reports, will have a tremendous effect upon our moral structure. Even the fear of it has already proved most disintegrating. But as the emergencies come closer, if they do, and we hope they do not, there must be ever more strength within the person to keep his own vision clear in the presence of situations over which he cannot personally exercise any general control. Here we have the second prong of our religious problem, and that is that among the great works of religion, perhaps the greatest, is to carry man through adversity. This is the final test of religion. For most people, religious integrity is measured by the ability of the believer to retain his own inner center of integration under the stress of circumstances. Thus, the religions we know must either be used to prevent trouble or to carry us in time of trouble. And both of these uses are valid. I think we must also generally realize that the atomic bomb, while it changes the pattern of our society, does not essentially change its hazards. Life becomes a little more dangerous, but this danger has always existed in some degree and to some measure. The life of the individual has always been in danger. Therefore, this is not the major consideration. The major consideration is that we have now the opportunity for a long and careful period of waiting in which our nervous systems become exhausted with anticipatory dreads. Instead of being able to rise to an emergency, we must face a long psychological depression of attitude and of resource. These things are harder to bear than the actual danger itself. Thus, we need to integrate as far as we can our spiritual integration or in our spiritual consciousness in this emergency. How are we going to go about it? What will be the problem of religion for us, perhaps for the next several hundred years, as we move more and more into this situation in which our skill can hazard every value which we possess? I think the simple answer for all these things is a series of deeply held, firmly believed acceptances. Man saves most of his energies by acceptance. By acceptance, we do not mean compromise. This is not the point at all. But we must face most of the problems that we cannot solve with the thought that is expressed in the Bible: suffer it to be so now. This too shall pass away. Therefore, what arises, what rises over the horizon of our experience must have a measure of acceptance. Today, we live in a world in which we will either spend most of our time worrying, being afraid, wondering, doubting, criticizing, or condemning, or else we must develop a consciousness of acceptance. Now, every negative attitude that we hold, every fear, doubt, and anxiety that we nourish is essentially bad for us. It is the same concept as that expressed in the Shakespearean play: the brave men die but once, and cowards die many deaths. The individual with an acceptance simply faces the fact. He brings to bear upon that fact all that he knows and all that he is, but he declines to dramatize it. He takes out of his entire concept of life the emotional superlatives with which he exhausts his own energies. Instead of saying that a thing is good or a thing is bad, the average person takes the attitude that it is awful, awful, awful good, or awful, awful, awful bad. Now, all these awfuls are a loss of time, a loss of energy, and a method of indoctrinating ourselves with a negative hypnotic technique. Now, I know that many people are so emotionally constructed that something has to be awful, awful, awful all the time, or they do not know how to live. But we're reaching the point where the world around us is producing so many intense situations that we can no longer afford to react to them with continually mounting tension, or we will disintegrate ourselves before the bomb has a chance. To meet this particular situation, we have to call upon some of the insight that has sustained others who have been good and wise and right down through the history of human endeavor. It has long been held that actually the human being is a kind of visitor in this world. Man is in this world, but not of it, by his very nature and constitution. His body extends into the sphere of matter, but his heart and his mind and his soul ascend into the mysterious worlds of creativity and idealism and spiritual value. Thus, while man lives here, his life can never be complete in the terms of the things that exist here. It makes not much difference how long he lives. For some it is not long enough, and for others it is too long. and for very few is it ever just right. Whatever we achieve, we must lay down the instruments of achievement in due time and pass them on to other generations. We are really almost strangers in the planet which we inhabit. We come for a time and we depart again. Materialists take the attitude that this is all of us. Well, if this is all of us, then there is very little of moment that merits much consideration. But to the religious person, this is not all of us. There is, in addition to this mortal existence, a life within us, a life which is the source of our strength, the source of our hope, and the very substance of our faith. If this life is real, if this inner self has an actual existence, this is the part that is important. These other things are comparatively unimportant. To hope in terms of important things is far better than to fear in terms of unimportant things. So if we are spiritually oriented in this life, we are capable of a series of acceptances. For underneath the surface of our various belligerences, we are creatures of continual acceptance. We may rebel, but we must finally accept the dictates of nature and the laws of heaven. We have no choice. Unfortunately, however, we are never sure the full measure of this problem of acceptance. We may find that the things we fear never do come about. All the more reason why we cannot wreck and destroy our own lives with unreasonable fears. If we can smooth down and simplify the attitudes of our own consciousness, we will be a long way ahead in the preservation of our essential religious convictions. Let's try to think of it this way, then. Let us say that if we want to belong to the religion of the atomic age, that we will realize the immediacy of everything we believe and everything that we think. Under this process, in which our time allotments become uncertain, now is the time for the attainment of all that is good. Now is the time of the practice of all that is virtuous. Now is the time for the kindness which we can no longer afford to delay. Therefore, in our religious life, now is always the moment for the practice of our faith. Now is the proper instant for the kind word, the good thought, and the helpful deed. Now is the time to share strength with those who need. Now is the time to know our children, to take a deeper interest in our friends. Now is the time to read the good book. Now is the time to develop the latent talents. Now is the time to do anything that needs to be done. We used to say, when we retire, we will begin to think. Now is the time when we must begin to think. We used to say, tomorrow I will phone my neighbor and wish her well. Now is the time to make that call. Things must move from the concept of infinite procrastination to immediate action. We can live a very long time in a short time if we live fully. The average person in the next 6 weeks could do most of the good deeds that he will ordinarily get around to in the next 25 years. Because he will space them out. This year he will make some little improvement in something. Next year he will mow the lawn. But in the next 6 weeks, we can pile together more value by real intent of purpose than we might ever have gotten around to among the continuing distractions of our careers. Therefore, religion, philosophy, art, music, culture, these things suddenly become things of now rather than things of sometime. Thoughtfulness is now. Sincerity is now. Honor is now. We are not going to live a little better when we get a little richer. The time to live better must be now. If we can move, therefore, from this long pattern of things to this immediate recognition of urgency, we can achieve that which is the purpose of our lives. Nature is not really particularly interested in how long we live. Nature may beam a kindly smile upon the centenarian, but it also afflicts him with numerous ills. The purpose of life is growth. Up to very recently, the whole concept of growth has gotten lost. In its place has come the idea that life is an adventure in the fulfillment of ambitions. Life is a kind of race in which the important thing is to reach the end as quickly as possible. We don't realize it, but that is the way we live. Instead of that, we have the possibility of experiencing all of the values of life in a comparatively short time. In this way, life is not shortened, because life really has nothing to do with counting birthdays. Life is actually the record of significant events which have enriched character. If in the normal occurrence of life, as we see it, the average person has a dozen of these significant events scattered over 70 or 80 years, and the rest of the time has been largely devoted to selfishness, thoughtlessness, and indifference. Actually, life, to this person, consists of 12 events. The rest is meaningless. Now, these events could have been brought much more closely together had we a realization of the importance of getting into life all the growth that we can. From a religious and spiritual standpoint, there's been considerable discussion, for example, about war. And the young men who went out, and in a very short time perhaps, lost their lives in the service of their country. We wonder whether or not their lives were really shortened, or whether the wasted time was simply squeezed out of them, and the significant things were all that was left. And one who came back after coming very near to death held this concept very close to himself. He said, in a few weeks, I lived a complete lifetime. And nothing that can happen over a long span of years can possibly equal what happened in a few weeks. So under our new concept of things, we can have this immediacy of achievement. Now this is of twofold advantage. First, we have no way of knowing that this bomb was ever going to drop. Maybe the world be wise enough not to let it. But if we do begin to build immediate accomplishment into consciousness, consider how much more we will have in real growth if we follow this pattern through a period of a normal lifetime. Supposing that the process of becoming better is recognized as so real and urgent that we begin the immediate practice of the principles that we hold to be true. And then we have a nice long life. Think how much we can get done. We can, might almost take the attitude that we can live the next 5 lives now and perhaps get a 2 weeks vacation somewhere along the line. We can outgrow our own weaknesses so much more rapidly if we take this attitude of immediacy. But if in 2, 5, 10 years bombs do fall, we don't know, we shall then know that regardless of what has happened, we have lived well. We have lived a full life. We have accomplished the purpose we came here to accomplish, and that was to grow. Beyond this, we need have no fear. For if anything survives, it is this accomplishment. And if we have kept faith with realities, realities will certainly keep faith with us. Under these situations, then, we have these two approaches to a spiritual code for this confused age. The first of these is acceptance and the other is immediacy. Let's consider this problem of acceptance in the terms of Zen or in some one of the great mystical systems of the world. If you have known very many people in this world, you have realized that individuals consistently destroy their own lives. They destroy them by building deep negative patterns. That nearly everyone has certain belligerencies in himself, resentments. These can become as habitual as alcohol or narcotics. And by degrees, we learn to resent everything. We no longer have any sense of value. We whip ourselves and then blame the universe. We destroy our own health and then blame our relatives. Step by step, we defeat our own characters, becoming in the end whiners, complainers, and open rebels, shaking our fists at heaven as though heaven would deign to notice. This kind of rejection, the rejection of the simple facts of things, will become a serious psychotic problem if we do not control it. Now, many people do not really go off the deep end in this. It just becomes a nagging factor all the way along through life. Something that takes out of life its richness, makes life poor and sloppy and comparatively meaningless. Thus, we defeat the experience of God in ourselves. For the whiner, the nagger, the fusser, and the fumer can never really experience the presence of God in consciousness. The acceptor accepts God with life. He thinks he is accepting a tragedy, but in that tragedy appears the luminous form of divinity. Acceptance is always the short way, the simple path that leads to understanding. As we have said, acceptance is not condoning. It is facing that which is necessary. If we have problems to decide, we use every means at our disposal that can be considered thoughtful, reasonable, and intelligent. We make use of every faculty we possess to bring reason and logic and common sense to bear. When we have done these things, we rest the case, ready to take whatever happens, because there is nothing more we can do about it. When we know there is nothing more that we can do, we generally relax. And the moment we are relaxed, the problem itself may evaporate, because problems are pressed into existence by tension alone. If the pressure of ourselves, of our own attitudes, if the exaggerations which we definitely contribute to a problem are removed, sometimes the problem becomes so insignificant that it appears ridiculous. But a little problem with a great deal of libido behind it can really become a nuisance. And most people have taken small things and fretted them into crises of one proportion or another. Zen, therefore, takes a very simple attitude on all of these problems. Just simply sit down quietly and realize your own identity with space, your own identity with the clear light of heaven, your own identity with the warm softness of the earth, that you are actually a being, that in yourself you are complete to yourself. Everything that you are contributes to your completeness. Everything that you think creates its own worlds. You live in a quietude that is disturbed only by yourself. You might as well get around to realizing that. If there's a lot of noise somewhere, you are making it, although it appears to be coming from elsewhere. If there are a lot of problems, you are making them. If there is confusion, this confusion is arising in yourself and not in facts. You live in a world of facts. You live in a world where black is black and white is white, or at least these are the names we have given these things. But most people are not happy about it. They want all the white things to be black and all the black things to be white. And if this change is not miraculously achieved, they decide to settle down and suffer for the rest of their lives. Some individuals insist that their own way is the right way, and that if nature will not adjust to them, they will declare war on nature. Well, this just worries nature to death. And instead of a great fight, we have another Don Quixote de la Mancha going out lancing windmills. And many people lance windmills all their lives. Actually, the facts of existence are acceptable to the consciousness of man. Man can live with facts. Man can live with them, work with them, and die with them, and come in the end to a pretty good adjustment with all of these facts. But when he begins to deceive himself, he cannot live with anything. When he begins to demand, he is lost. So everything that we face is either a fact or it is nothing. A fact we can always adapt to. But nothing can take on a thousand mysterious, fantastic forms which still have no substance in any of them. So the great problems of life are the ones which are non-factual, problems which we invent, problems which we go out of our way to sustain, problems for which we will sacrifice years of thought. And when we are through, we have achieved nothing. For we have been chasing a will-o'-the-wisp that never did have any substance in it. So acceptance cuts down wear and tear and enables us to cope without emotionalization. Wars are very largely emotionalization. So is crime. The strange, crooked codes of deceivers have nothing in common with fact. But men have accepted them and struggled with them and suffered with them and died for them. And when it was all done, nothing was accomplished. But when we give our life to an error, we've wasted that life. Nature has tried to tell us this for a long time, but no one was listening. In this atomic age, we have now to become factual. Factual does not mean cold. It does not mean matter of fact, as we use the term. It does not mean the loss of the warmth and the color of life. It simply means the loss of distortion. The loss of these grimacing ghosts and demons with which we have populated the world in which we live. Facts have the true warmth of a great reality. A great Japanese artist many years ago said that he was convinced that the greatest thing in all the world was the fact in art. And he defined this fact, as he said, the utter humility of art. Humility is its fact. Great art is always humble. Great art and great lives are humble. And humbleness is factual. Humbleness is the common clay molded into the simple cup from which a man drinks. 1,500 years ago, a Korean potter, probably a farmer, certainly a person of no estate, evidently got thirsty. And when you get thirsty, what do you do about it? You get a drink. This is very simple, but it is the highest form of reason. And because evidently he wanted a cup to drink with, he made one. Now the cup he made was just as crude as he could make it, because it was for one purpose only, to provide him with a drink. He didn't try to make a cup. But because he didn't even try, something happened to the cup. It suddenly became a product of internal motion. He simply did it without knowing what he was doing or caring. But because he was himself, he pushed it in a little on this side, touched it down a little on that side in the clay, to make it, you know, look the way he liked to have it. This cup got buried somewhere in Korea after it had served its purpose. And 1,500 years later, it was dug up. And it was taken to a great museum. And the great critics and the connoisseurs looked at this little cup that some Korean farmer had made, who probably could neither read nor write. And one said, of the critic said to the other, it is perfection. Never could we improve upon this work of art. It has the most wonderful quality of all, and that is humility. It is simple. It was made only for a purpose. But in making it and in fulfilling its purpose, it has been fashioned a thing of exquisite beauty. This is fact. The simplicity of things is their beauty. And these principles that move inside of us are just destroyed by our own emotional overtones. After we've studied art long enough, we couldn't make that cup. It would be utterly impossible. That cup had to be made by the soul, not by the trained technician. And that is why folk art is the art of God in man, and is sometimes the greatest art of all. This simple thing is the Zen idea of acceptance. There is no problem unless we make a problem. Now, the atomic bomb stands there and looks awful like a problem. It has the appearance of one. We read about it. It sounds like one. We wonder how anyone can say this is no problem. It isn't, actually. It will either explode or it will not explode. And about this, there is really no problem. There is the constant need for man's being able to adjust, to accept, and to move on from acceptance without fear. This acceptance means that if he survives, he will be of the greatest help in the restoring of his world. If he does not survive, he will go forth into a better world, perhaps, than he has ever known. These problems are simple acceptances. It has been observed also that where an individual is very sick, that one of the most important things in the world is to get a certain acceptance, a certain conscious understanding, a final acceptance of the fact. Thousands of persons who would otherwise have died have lived because they were able to achieve a state of acceptance. Rebellion would have killed them in a month in the precarious situation they were in. But acceptance released all of nature's energies for reclamation purposes. And almost miraculous recoveries have been reported from such conditions. Because the individual simply got out of his own way. And because he did not add the pressure of his own fear, he recovered. In every walk of life, pressure destroys judgment, limits utility and efficiency, detracts from our peace of mind, destroys the days that we have. Whatever the days may be, long or short, let us use them and not abuse them. Let each day be as full of beauty and of truth and of understanding as possible.